Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. I'm Will Aitchison. I'll be your host while we go through the past 30 days' activities in the public safety, labor, and employment world. I'm not going to say all that much about COVID-19 in this podcast. We have put out two special podcasts in the last week, one of them on what you need to be looking for in your COVID-19 policies in terms of labor and employment issues. The other one dealing with some of the legal principles that are being brought to bear with respect to COVID-19 in the workplace. Both of those podcasts are on our website. Both of them are free. Feel free to access them. And we've got a lot of materials that we have posted on the website that go along with those podcasts. So I'm going to take a little bit of a break, almost, from talking about COVID-19 and talk about some cases in the last 30 days, because we've got some pretty interesting ones. But the reason I said almost is we've had three things happen in the last day. I am recording this on Tuesday, March 31st. Three things happened in the last day that stem from COVID-19 and have, well, at least one of them, I think, is going to have a pretty big impact in the public safety labor world. So first of all, let's talk about presumptive causation laws. These are these statutes that exist in various states around the country where if a public safety employee, more commonly firefighters, but law enforcement officers quite a bit as well, that if a public safety employee contracts a particular type of disease, then there is a presumption that that disease is caused by the job. Long time ago, these used to be referred to as heart-lung bills because the diseases to which they applied typically were cardiovascular diseases and pulmonary diseases. They've expanded over the years. It's not uncommon to see one of these statutes cover things like hepatitis, and PTSD is increasingly the subject of expansion in these presumptive causation laws. Well, we have seen public safety employees focused on whether or not the workers' compensation laws in their states will be changed in order to create a presumptive causation for public safety employees who come down with COVID-19. And the laws haven't, or the bills to create these laws haven't really gone that far because most legislatures are not in session. But we just had our first one hit a legislature, first one that I know about, and it was in Minnesota. And it would have covered not just public safety employees, first responders, it also would have covered medical personnel. It ended up being bound up in a big package that the Minnesota legislature was considering. And as part of the deal that the Democrats, and they have a different name in Minnesota, but I'll call them Democrats. Part of the deal that the Democrats and the Republicans made is that four leadership people had to agree on what was going to go into this whole package. And if all four of them couldn't agree, then on a particular item, that item was out of the package. And that's what happened to the presumptive causation for COVID-19. You had, at least as far as the news sources I've been able to see, say you had three of the four agreed, both Democrats agreed that presumptive causation should apply. One Republican did, but a fourth individual, a Republican, balked at that. And as a result, it didn't get included in the kind of the omnibus bill that the Minnesota legislature was considering and ended up getting passed. And that left the presumptive causation bill somewhere in the dust. First responders got quite angry at that. There was a demonstration, keeping appropriate social distance, demonstration on the steps of the Capitol building in Minnesota. You see voices from various parts of the legislature there saying, I think we might have made a mistake on this. And so it may well get revisited sooner rather than later. But that's, as I said, the first time I've seen one of these bills come up for a vote before a state legislature. Second thing that's happened in the last 24 hours is a very interesting development dealing with the California Peace Officers Bill of Rights. Now, California has two bills of rights. One covers roughly law enforcement officers, and the other is the most comprehensive firefighter bill of rights in the nation. Both of them have a time limit on the conduct of an internal affairs investigation. And they say, look, if you take more than a year to conduct an internal affairs investigation, then you have blown the statute of limitations and you may not discipline the employee. What's happened in California is that the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, issued an executive order that extends all sorts of timelines for all sorts of things in California state statutes. It's really a potpourri of items in this executive order, and we'll post the executive order on our website if you are counting. It's executive order N-40-20. One of the timelines that was postponed by 60 days in this executive order is the time limit for completing an internal affairs investigation for law enforcement officers. Employers get another 60 days, not for firefighters. The executive order didn't address that bill, the statute for firefighters. Whether that was an oversight or not is completely unclear, but now you're in this odd situation in California where employers have a year and 2 months to complete an investigation of a law enforcement officer and a year to complete an investigation of a firefighter. The last of the developments comes to us from Philadelphia. You're probably aware that the police community relationship in Philadelphia has been quite challenged in the last few years. You have one of these progressive prosecutors who got elected, and he and the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the rank and file bargaining unit in Philadelphia, have been publicly sparring over a variety of different things. They have a new police chief, Danielle Outlaw. They kind of grabbed her out of my home city of Portland. She'll do a great job there, by the way, if she survives the politics, the very rough politics in that city. And you had demonstrations against the police and the public. And layered on top of that were last year's events where the Plain View Project released all sorts of posts that had been made by Philadelphia police officers on Facebook, posts that led to the discipline of over 60 officers in Philadelphia, some of them terminations, some of them suspensions. So when the city and the FOP are coming into bargaining, and they've been bargaining for a few months now, there are a lot of expectations on everybody's side. You have some members of the public saying, we want to get rid of binding arbitration because the FOP wins too often when it arbitrates disciplinary sanctions. You have some people in the public saying we need to give these police officers a big raise because of what they have to put up with. And you got people all over the spectrum there. And it had already become quite a topic of public discussion in Philadelphia as to how are you going to resolve this contract? How are you going to work this thing out? Well, you know what they did yesterday? They agreed to roll over the contract for 1 year. And it's, or extended, I guess, would be the correct term. It's not an extension that is exactly the status quo. There's a 2.5% raise increase for officers in, or the FOP in this package. And in addition to that, there is a $750 annual bonus, although it's being extended by 1 year. So, of course, it's going to be an annual bonus. There is also an agreement on the part of the FOP that internal harassment complaints, so sexual harassment, racial harassment, that sort of stuff, will now be investigated outside of the police department, It'll be investigated by a separate city agency. But that appears to be it. And beyond that, it's just a one-year extension of the contract. Why? COVID-19. People are too busy to focus on expiring contracts right now. They're just struggling to get their normal jobs done, never mind trying to negotiate a new contract. This is the development that I think is going to be maybe the most significant of the three that I just talked about. And the reason is I think this is going to be emulated in a lot of places. You're going to see management and labor start to approach each other when we calm down a little bit here and say, hey, why don't we just extend this thing for a year or two? Maybe you want to talk about one or two or three items or something like that, but let's get the contract bargaining done in a day or two or an hour or two or whatever it might be, so that we can focus on other things and we can put everybody's mind to rest about the contract. I bet you're going to see a lot of this coming up. Now to the first of the cases that I wanted to talk about this month. This one comes to us courtesy of the Vermont Supreme Court. You don't see too many public safety labor cases coming out of Vermont. I sort of have this image of everybody in Vermont that they all just kind of sit down and work things out. You don't end up in litigation too often. Maybe they're all sitting around a table enjoying a bowl of Ben and Jerry's. That comes from Vermont, right, I think. At any rate, this one was a little bit of a dispute, and it involves something that we see a lot of these days. And what it involves is an agreement with a prospective employee that if they leave within a certain amount of time, they're going to have to repay the costs that the employer paid training them. So what are the facts here? This involves the town of Bennington, Vermont, and it hires Clay Knight to work as a full-time patrol officer starting February 1 of 2015. The town required him to sign an agreement promising to work for the department for 3 years, and if he didn't, he would have to reimburse, and I'm quoting now, the cost paid in stipend / salary and benefits, employer's social security contribution, and workman's compensation insurance during the training period. And this repayment obligation would be prorated at the rate of 1/36th reduction per month of service. So every month that goes by, Knight is on the hook for a little bit less in the way of a repayment of training costs. Well, Knight makes it until June 30, 2017. He's got 7 months left on his three-year term. Would the department let him walk away on the theory that it might cost a lot more to pursue him in court than it would recover if it won? No, it didn't. Probably wanted to set an example with him for other individuals. So the department sued him, and it sued Knight to recover $3,831.15. And that issue, whether or not that training cost agreement was enforceable, that issue went to the Vermont Supreme Court. So what does the Vermont Supreme Court say? It says, look, this sort of agreement, the repayment of training court costs, this sort of agreement is kind of, it's generally enforceable, except if it conflicts with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. And in this case, the court found the agreement that covered Knight conflicted with the contract. What? What in the contract? The salary provisions under the contract. Here's what the court says, and I'm quoting. Under the contract, as a trainee who had not yet received police certification, Knight was entitled to his step one salary. The employment agreement required that he refund a prorated portion of that salary to the town unless he remained in employment for 3 years. This payback requirement directly conflicts with the contract, which unconditionally promised Knight a specified salary during his training period. The employer argued that this side agreement, or however you want to term this, was enforceable because the contract didn't promise Knight free training and certification, and he was merely being required to repay the costs of the benefit. The court said, yeah, we agree with you. The contract doesn't say anything about repaying the cost of training, but you have to remember that this contract with Knight was a one-on-one contract with him, and it was not negotiated with the union. And since it was not negotiated with the union, there can be no variation from the salary clause in the contract. Now, these repayment of training costs provisions or agreements that you see, they have sort of an unusual treatment in the law. Let's start with the presumption that you have no collective bargaining whatsoever. So let's say you're in Jackson, Mississippi, where there is no bargaining. Bargaining actually is against the law in Mississippi for public safety employees. In fact, for all public employees, it's against the law. Let's say you've got a newly minted Jackson police officer who signs this sort of contract. Is it enforceable if that officer leaves in the absence of a collective bargaining structure? And the answer is yeah. There are cases that say that. It just simply can't violate federal law. How could it violate federal law? The repayment might actually take the employee below the minimum wage required by the Fair Labor Standards Act. But if you can get around that and it's easy enough to write a repayment clause that specifies that the repayment won't ever take the employee below the FLSA's threshold, in the absence of collective bargaining, these sorts of agreements are in fact enforceable. But most states have collective bargaining for public safety employees. Are these clauses enforceable in the presence of a collective bargaining law or a collective bargaining relationship? And the answer is no, not unless the union signs off on them. Why? It's the basic principle: if there is to be an agreement about a mandatory subject of bargaining, it must be between the employer and the union, not individual members of the union. One-on-one agreements between bargaining unit members and employers are not valid in a collective bargaining situation unless the union signs off on them. And there's a reason that this sort of direct dealing is considered very universally to be against the law, to breach the employer's obligation to collectively bargain in good faith. And it's because if the employer would be free to make these one-on-one deals with members of the union that might be beneficial to some or might be harmful to others, then it would undercut the union's ability to negotiate on behalf of everyone. Now, let's say you're in a collective bargaining environment and the collective bargaining agreement allows for the repayment of training costs. Is that enforceable? So you have the union signing off on the deal. And the answer is, yeah, now it becomes enforceable so long as you don't go below that FLSA floor. So a little bit of a complicated situation here. Generally speaking, if I were advising employers about these sorts of clauses, I would probably say not worth the effort. Not worth the effort to get them signed, face potential litigation from the union about whether or not they are legal, and certainly not worth pursuing the likes of Clay Knight for $3,831.15. I can only imagine the cost-benefit analysis that went into that. I'd now like to go over to Chicago and talk about, I think, a really important case about the relationship between grievance procedures in a contract and injunctions. I can't tell you how many times in my career I have had a client ask me, can we get an injunction to stop this violation of the contract, whatever it might be? And my answer so far, every time, has been, no, you can't. Why not? Well, the Chicago case illustrates why it is so, so difficult, almost impossible, not quite impossible, but almost impossible for a union to get an injunction to stop a contract violation. So what's going on in Chicago? And by the way, this is going to be the first of what appears to be an awful lot of litigation coming out of the Chicago Police Department on labor and employment issues. You have another one of these very toxic relationships between the union and the employer. You have an expired collective bargaining agreement. Everybody's got all sorts of grievances they're bringing to the table. And you have now the employer, like all employers, going to be facing the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. That's all just kind of a nasty sort of recipe for litigation. And I think we can anticipate seeing a lot of Chicago cases. So what's this one about? Well, since about 2009, most patrol officers in the Chicago Police Department have had a work schedule in which they work an 8.5-hour day, 4 on, 2 off. And typically, they work in 3 shifts. You have both a pre-relief shift and a late release shift for each of these. And then you have a variety of different day-off groups, as they're called, 6 different day-off groups. Patrol officers in Chicago often team up with partners for their patrol duties. They're 2-person cars. And the partners are usually given the same day-off group so that they can work together. And they end up in the same day-off group with other officers for long periods of time. And that's to the benefit of officers who know well in advance what days they will have off over the course of a year. Well, in 2017, you have the Department of Justice issuing that blockbuster report about the Chicago Police Department that determines that the police department engaged in a pattern and practice of violating the civil rights of citizens, particularly with respect to the use of force. One of the recommendations in the report was that the rotational work schedule for patrol officers, this 4-2 schedule, where you're having different days off every week, if you think about it, one of the findings was that this work schedule meant that the officers were not consistently scheduled to be supervised by the same sergeants and lieutenants, which prevented an effective chain of command. Or in the wording of the Department of Justice, that sort of system, and I'm quoting, prevents supervisors from establishing mentoring relationships with officers and providing guidance targeted to the particular needs of each individual officer. Well, the consent decree, the Department of Justice study ended up becoming the basis of a consent decree that was entered January 31, 2019. And that consent decree required the department to implement a staffing model by January 31 of 2020 to achieve, and I'm quoting, unity of command so that officers and supervisors regularly had the same start time, the same day off group, and the same geographic patrol areas. 2019 moves along. In August, the department notifies the FOP that it intended to reduce the number of day off groups from 6 to 3 in one of the districts of the department as part of a pilot program. And then in November of 2019, the department notified the lodge that effective January 9th of 2020, there'd be modified start times. The lodge, which has a collective bargaining agreement, albeit an expired one, but has a in a collective bargaining agreement that has a clause on start times, filed a grievance. And it filed actually two grievances, at least two, challenging both of these anticipated changes, the changes in the day off groups and the changing in the changes in the start times. The grievance, the lodge asked to have this expedited and also sought to have the changes delayed until a new contract could be negotiated. That's not going to be for a long time, but that's what the FOP asked for. The city said no to both of those. So the FOP then filed a lawsuit seeking an injunction to hold the schedules at the status quo pending resolution of the grievances. And the FOP also wanted the judge to order expedited arbitration. So what's the result? This ends up in the Illinois Court of Appeals, got there incredibly fast. If you think about it, all this stuff was happening in January of 2020. Here we are at the end of March, and we have the case through the trial court and out of the Illinois Court of Appeals. And the court says, no injunction. Why not? Well, it's because of the standards, the legal standards for getting injunctions. And there are several of them, and they all typically have to be met. And one of the standards is that in order to get an injunction, whether it's an injunction against an employer violating a collective bargaining agreement or an injunction against somebody breaching a non-compete clause or whatever it might be, if you're going to get an injunction, you have to show what the courts call irreparable harm. And what that means in this context is that the remedies, the other remedies you have available, are not adequate. And in the context of labor arbitration, that you would have to be able to show, in order to get an injunction pending an arbitration, you would have to show, and I'm turning now to the words of the Court of Appeals, that the arbitrator's award, quote, would be inadequate to fully recompense the injured party, rendering the award an empty victory. And thus, without the injunction, you'd have harm to the entire arbitration process. And the court says, we don't see that here. The FOP has not met this very difficult burden of proof. Why? Turning to the court's opinion again. There is no evidence here that the former work schedules and day off groups could not be restored in arbitration. The losses pertaining to childcare responsibilities and change patrol partnerships are not the type which threaten the integrity of the arbitral process. And here comes the zinger. The fact that a potential arbitration award might not compensate for the full extent of disruption that may occur in officers' lives from the changes to the work schedule or day off groups does not render the arbitration meaningless or justify an injunction. And I do have to read you, I've read you a lot of this opinion, but I do have to read you one more sentence. It's the last sentence, effective sentence in the court's opinion. And I think it tells you where the court's coming from here. Quoting, if disruption of workers' lives and habits from changes in work schedules was deemed sufficient harm on which to bottom injunctive relief, then the exception would swallow the rule and the courts would be mired hip deep in matters which Congress intended to remit to arbitration. So no injunction because you can't show irreparable harm. You can't show that the remedies available in the arbitration system are inadequate. So what sort of remedies would the FOP be seeking here? And unfortunately, we don't know this from the court's opinion. But I can tell you I've handled several of these cases over the years. And I'll tell you what I think the FOP is likely to be asking for and what the city may well be at risk in having to do. So think about this for a moment. You are with these changes. The city is contemplating changing both the starting times and the days off of patrol officers. In other words, patrol officers in Chicago are going to be working, are working, hours that would normally be outside of their regular shifts. What do you get if you normally work an hour outside of your regular shift? Overtime. Now, you're already being paid straight time for those hours because the total number of hours that the employee is working over the course of a year or week or whatever measurement is going to be the same. You're just changing starting times and day off groups. So effectively, what you do is you subtract from that time and a half that you would get from overtime, you subtract the straight time rate from that, and you end up with what is sometimes called a halftime remedy. This is a remedy the National Labor Relations Board has awarded. It's one that arbitrators have awarded, and it's one that the city of Chicago may end up facing. But for our purposes for this podcast today, I just want you to remember this. Injunctions, almost impossible to get pending an arbitration process. While we're talking about arbitration, let's talk about this kind of a bombshell case that comes out of Columbus, Ohio, and the police department there. This is a case that's gotten a lot of notoriety in Columbus, and it's because of the facts of the case. So what's going on in this case, and what do we see from this arbitrator's opinion that is important? So this is a case that involves a 17-year veteran police officer who's working for the Columbus Police Department. In this arbitrator's opinion, this officer is only referred to as Officer A. By the way, that's common. When you have termination cases that end up getting published, usually the names of key witnesses and the grievant and sometimes other employees will be redacted or anonymized, and that's what you see here. So we only know this guy as Officer A. The department receives an internal affairs complaint about him. What's the complaint allege? Three different women, Ms. B, Ms. C, and Ms. D, reported that they had sex with Officer A in exchange for cash while he was on duty as a Columbus police officer. All three women gave internal affairs independent recollections of their encounters with Officer A. The recollections were very similar in nature. And at the conclusion of the IA investigation, the city fired Officer A, concluding that, among other things, he was guilty of patronizing the prostitutes. The Officers' Labor Organization in Columbus, it's the Fraternal Order of Police, disputed the charges and challenged the termination in arbitration. And the arbitrator ends up overturning the termination, but not giving the officer any back pay. So let's talk about what the arbitrator's reasoning was, because that's what's really important here. The problem, said the arbitrator, is that the city did not call the three accusers as witnesses. The way the arbitrator puts it is that, you know, this is a credibility issue. On one hand, you have the officer denying that any of this happened, and on the other hand, you have the accuser's accusations that the acts took place. I was able to see, says the arbitrator, the officer testify at some length. He was subject to a very long cross-examination. He denied the accusations of having sex, and I was able to watch him do that. The accusers did not have their accounts tested through the same process. And here's what the arbitrator ends up holding, and it is a basic presumption. You even see this in jury instructions in courts. And I'm quoting, "The failure of a party to call an available witness gives rise to a presumption that the witness's testimony would be adverse to the position of the party who could have called them." This is not simply a matter of dry legal doctrine. The arbitrator at the hearing, he's talking about himself now, had the opportunity to observe the officer while he testified, specifically with respect to his demeanor and reaction. At the hearing, the officer was subject to lengthy cross-examination by the employer's skilled attorney. You gotta love arbitrators who throw attorneys a bone, particularly when you know you're gonna end up losing the case. Back to the opinion, there was no such opportunity for the arbitrator to observe the three accusers on the stand and their demeanor and reaction, nor were they subjected to the cross-examination, which is one of the hallmarks of testing the validity of accusations. The contrast bespeaks of an inherent imbalance in the arbitration hearing. And as a result, the arbitrator ends up concluding that the city did not meet its burden of proving that the officer patronized prostitutes. So what about the reinstatement without back pay? Why? Why, if the charges were not proven, why wasn't this officer reinstated with full back pay? And the arbitrator says, well, you know what? Where there's smoke, there's fire. And if, in fact, that were the standard that I had to apply, he would have been found guilty of the charges. But I can't apply that standard. I have to apply a burden of proof standard. And when I watched this officer testify, I saw him be careful to admit things that he could not plausibly deny, such as the location of his police car at various times as shown by GPS systems. So he pretty much did everything except admit engaging in sex with known prostitutes in exchange for money. The officer, and I'm quoting, did not cover himself with glory in the course of these events and will bear close supervision in subsequent work. So the arbitrator says, you know, you put this all together, you put the fact that, you know, he was out of his patrol district and he admitted to all sorts of different, more minor violations of the department's rules, and you put that all together, and while I think he should be reinstated because of the city's failure to meet its burden of proof, I don't think he should get any back pay. Let me say, I hate that sort of result, reinstatement without back pay. And I know a lot of lawyers on both management and labor side who hate that result. Why? If you think about it, what it does is to tie the amount of punishment not to the degree of fault or culpability on the part of the employee. It rather ties the amount of punishment to how long the arbitration process takes. So if you have a reinstatement with back pay, a decision from an arbitrator, and the arbitrator's decision is 4 months out from when the grievance was filed, well, then the officer is punished with 4 months of no back pay. But what if it takes 12 months to get to arbitration, or 16 months? And some of these complicated cases do. And in those circumstances, for exactly the same misconduct that might have produced a 4-month suspension in the first example I give you, now we have the employee who's going to be penalized with a 12-month or an 18-month suspension. Doesn't make much sense. But nonetheless, arbitrators will do it, and they will typically do it in these sorts of cases where you have an arbitrator who is saying things out loud like, where there's smoke, there's fire. And if only the city had called these three women as witnesses, I might have gone the other way. The last case I want to talk about comes to us from Arizona, and it involves post-traumatic stress disorder and workers' comp claims. And this is a case where we end up seeing a court, and this is an intermediate court of appeals, the Arizona Court of Appeals, actually, it seems to me, changed the standard for when PTSD claims are to be considered as compensable under the law. If you look around the country and look at different workers' compensation systems, you're going to see that unless you find one of these presumptive causation laws where PTSD is presumed to be caused by the job, you're going to see standards that make it very, very difficult for an employee to recover on a PTSD workers' compensation claim. And that had been the case with Arizona. Courts and legislatures are just simply, they're very cautious in the whole area of mental disabilities, mental diseases, mental injuries, because they're worried that employees may be faking these sorts of things or at least taking advantage of a bad situation. So when you look at the PTSD claims around the country, by and large, you see them be pretty unsuccessful, even where the underlying facts are horrific. And they were horrific in this Arizona case. And I think the horrific nature of the facts may be what persuaded the court to change the legal standard, albeit without actually saying out loud that it's changing the legal standard. Okay, so I've teased you enough with this case. What's going on? It involves Arizona Deputy Sheriff John France and an incident that happened in June 2017 in Gila County, Arizona. France and another deputy were dispatched to a residence. This was a call for a man who was threatening to kill himself with a shotgun. When they arrived at the house, a man burst through the doorway between the two deputies holding a shotgun in a shooting stance. The man pointed the shotgun at France and screamed in rage. He then rushed towards France, his shotgun only a few feet away from France's face and torso. He ignored repeated requests to drop his weapon. And because the man was between them, neither of the two deputies could act without endangering the other. Eventually, France backs around the corner of the house with the gunman in pursuit, but that means that the two deputies are no longer in each other's field of fire. They each shot the man several times before he finally fell to the ground, where France watched him die. By mid-July, so a month after this event, France had been diagnosed with PTSD as a result of this incredible situation, and he filed a workers' compensation claim. The sheriff's office conceded that France did suffer from PTSD, but disagreed whether or not it was a compensable injury under the law. Why? How, if it concedes that this is work-related PTSD, why wouldn't it be a compensable injury? And the answer is that Arizona followed a standard that's followed in many states. You need to check your state and see whether or not this is the standard followed there. That PTSD is only compensable if it arises out of, and I'm quoting, some unexpected, unusual, or extraordinary stress related to the employment. That was at least the standard under Arizona law. And in fact, the city ended up winning at the first level on this case before an administrative law judge. And the ALJ ends up saying that while this incident was, quote, psychologically extraordinary, that did not mean that it was, quote, legally extraordinary. And the ALJ ended up saying that to accept France's claim as compensable under the workers' compensation system, and I'm quoting, would reduce industrial insurance to a general health and accident insurance, which it is not. France appeals then to the Arizona Court of Appeals. So you have Have pretty fertile ground here for a court to make changes in the law. You have this horrible incident, and then you compound it with an ALJ's opinion that is, at a minimum, tone deaf to the entire situation. And the Court of Appeals ends up overturning the ALJ's decision and awarding France benefits. And what does the court do? The court says, well, look, at first blush, our prior cases addressing mental injuries seem to suggest that the injury-causing event was not contemplated as part of a deputy's job responsibilities. Responding to this sort of call, encountering people who are armed, who may be threatening to kill you, we can see, says the court, how under our prior cases, you might think that PTSD under these circumstances would not be compensable because, you know, that's part of a deputy's job. And workers' compensation only goes if the underlying event is outside of the normal stress related to employment. And the court ends up saying, you know, we understand where the ALJ is coming from here, and we're going to take a slightly different tack. And what's the different tack we're going to take? And I'm quoting from the court's opinion. The issue to be resolved here, where the confrontation that precipitated France's PTSD was undoubtedly work-related, was not whether the event was unexpected, unusual, or extraordinary, but rather whether the stress to which France was exposed was unexpected, unusual, or extraordinary. This is a difference, the court says, that is subtle. It's subtle, all right. It's pretty much so subtle that it's non-existent. But let's go back to the court's opinion. An event such as the dispatch of a law enforcement officer to investigate a report of threatened violence may be routine. The stress of the event, which here included staring down the barrel of a loaded shotgun held by a screaming, manic gunman, carefully repositioning to avoid injury to a fellow deputy and shooting and killing another human being at point-blank range, may not be routine. And the problem with the ALJ's findings here were that those findings focused on the nature of the event and not the nature of the stress. So when we look at this, says the court, we see that this phrase, unexpected, unusual, or extraordinary stress, must be, and I'm going to quote again, because this is where the court is changing the standard, to use its own word subtly, but it is changing the standard. The phrase, unexpected, unusual, or extraordinary stress related to employment, must be read as a whole, and in a more general sense, to mean simply that the injury-inducing stress imposed upon the employee by virtue of his employment was sufficiently significant and noteworthy to differentiate it from the daily wear and tear of living. Wow, that's pretty huge, right? That means that pretty much any time you have a law enforcement officer in this sort of situation where you have a critical incident, pretty much any time that officer is going to be able to argue that the stress that was produced in that incident was different from the daily wear and tear of living. So I think what has happened with respect to Arizona law on the compensability of PTSD claims is that thanks to Deputy John France and his perseverance in this litigation, I think the law has opened up more to PTSD claims. All right, I want to end this podcast with a little bit of a comment about where we are in LRIS. I know some of you have registered for our upcoming seminars, and I want to try to give you as much of an update as I possibly can. As I mentioned earlier, I'm recording this on the last day of March, and at the moment, things are pretty much up in the air. We are still scheduled for our Rights of Law Enforcement Officers seminar in June in Las Vegas. We are still planning to put on that seminar, but that is, as you know, a day-to-day decision. What we will do is we will keep everybody who's registered for that seminar, we will keep you informed as to what it is we are doing, what it is we are hearing, and if we have to reschedule that seminar, of course, we'll honor everybody's registrations at whenever the rescheduled seminar is. The best predictions we are hearing right now is that the social distancing requirements that exist in a variety of places, including in Las Vegas where the seminar is, are likely to be, or most likely to be, eased somewhere around 4 to 8 weeks from now, which would mean the seminar could still go on. But, you know, we appreciate your patience in these times. We don't want to do anything that's unsafe for any of our seminar attendees. We won't hesitate to postpone this seminar if we have any caution at all about it going on. But for now, we're keeping the situation as planned, keeping the seminar as planned to go off as scheduled. Our next seminar is in July. It's the wellness seminar. This one is a seminar that was, at the time we had to postpone it, it was scheduled for April. This seminar was close to selling out, a very popular seminar. Right now, it's looking like that one is going to be on as well. And then our other seminars are in the balance of the year, kind of too far out to talk about at this point in time. So, as I said just a moment ago, thanks for your patience with respect to this. It's just part of all of us hanging together right now as we're going through these very, very most extraordinary times. Thanks for listening to the podcast. This is Will Aitchison signing off.